Hi there, it's Bean. Welcome to an all-new Great Moments in Weed History. In this episode, I sit down and talk shop with two journalists who are not afraid to get in the weeds when it comes to reporting on this plant that we all love. As dedicated cannabis reporters, their job requires investigating every aspect of this beat, including the industry, the politics, the culture, the smoky backroom deals, the push for social justice and equity, and most important, trying to get to the bottom of how the hell do you lose money selling weed? Well, the classic way is by getting high on your own supply. But something tells me the bean counters in charge of corporate cannabis didn't just smoke up the $4 billion in losses they collectively posted in 2022. That's a real figure, by the way, compiled from publicly available information. Hat tip to the financial reporters over at Green Market Report. Anyway, according to my sources, apparently a lot has changed in the weed game since the days when you'd buy an ounce, sell 5/8, smoke the rest for free, and still have some profits left over. Although, I have heard that particular business model is making a comeback big time. My own career as a cannabis journalist started exactly 20 years ago at High Times Magazine, back when it was cool. High Times was cool back then. But in those days, being a weed reporter was actually something that got you clowned on. As the example to prove the rule, in 2002, the very year I arrived at that journalistic institution, none other than the great Jack Black portrayed a High Times reporter on Saturday Night Live. And, well, to be honest, it was pretty cliche stuff. He wore a tie-dye shirt and had dreadlocks. He was kind of dopey, and he investigated wild conspiracies about the government secretly growing weed.
Last question.
Excuse me, sir. But is it the truth that the government has a huge field of high potency pot that they grow just for the president and Congress?
Who are you?
Russell Putnam, investigative reporter, High Times Magazine.
Of course, those of you who listened to the most recent episode of this podcast know that the U.S. government has indeed been growing weed since at least the 1970s, because that's when the feds started supplying Robert Randall with 10 joints a day. He was America's first ever federal medical cannabis patient, and the government sent him free weed for the rest of his life. Don't believe me? Go into the podcast archive and listen to that episode. Also, quick follow-up on Jack Black. He's been advocating for cannabis for a long, long time and is most definitely one of us.
The first decree is to legalize marijuana. The tyranny and the bullshit's gone on too long. You old fucking shrimps who blocked its legalization. You're banished from the land where leaders decay.
Anyway, much respect to Jack Black, but my personal favorite portrayal of a cannabis journalist in popular culture is actually from an old College Humor web series that was a parody of the TV show The Office, except instead of a mid-sized paper company, it was set in the offices of High Times Magazine.
Hey.
Can you listen to me? There's a new strand right out of Maui, and honestly, it's the smoothest thing I've ever seen. And we got our Hawaii correspondent on it, but he's going to need help. Now, guys, this is the big one. We can scoop on week if we work fast. Gruber.
Yes, sir.
What?
Huh?
I don't know where I am now.
Hawaii, sir.
Of course, Hawaii. Gruber, get on a plane. Andrews, handle it locally. And Collins, Pop-Tart. Thank you, Collins. Can I get another Pop-Tart, please? I didn't go in my mouth.
That's the very funny Ben Schwartz playing the editor of High Times. In all seriousness, though, my two guests on this episode exemplify what it means to be a cannabis journalist in 2023, and as such, they are very busy writing the first draft of weed history as it unfolds. Fortunately, they each took a break from digging up the dirt to give us a peek behind the scenes of how legal weed really works and who it works for. Let's meet our guests. Tahid Chappelle is an executive board member of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists. He's worked for the Washington Post, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the Free Press. Tahita is also an adjunct professor at Thomas Jefferson University, where he teaches a course on equity movements in the cannabis space. And in late breaking news, he's just this week been named the first ever executive director of the New Jersey Department of State's Cannabis Training Academy, which is the first cannabis academy supported and run by a state government agency. That's kind of mind-blowing. I'm also joined by Jelani Gibson, who covers the legal weed beat for New Jersey Cannabis Insider, a joint effort from NJ.com and the Star Ledger. Previously, Jelani was a gun violence reporter for the Kansas City Star and an education reporter and photojournalist for the U.S. Air Force. Now, before we dive into this fascinating discussion, I do want to give a huge thanks to everyone who supports this podcast on Patreon. You are the reason this podcast is going strong after more than 4 years and almost 100 episodes. If you want to join us, you can go to greatmomentsinweedhistory.com, sign up for as little as a dollar, and you will get a new show every week. You will get the ad-free version of this podcast. You will get the video version of this podcast. You'll see me waving at you. And for a little more support, you can get a signed copy of my book, How to Smoke Pot Properly, sent right to your door. And that's all at greatmomentsinweedhistory.com. Also, just a heads up, you should definitely subscribe to Great Moments in Weed History right now, wherever you get podcasts, because if all goes according to plan, we're going to be releasing a very special episode sometime between now and 7/10, the hashish holiday, and it won't be on our typical Weedness Day schedule. So subscribe now and you'll never miss an episode of this show. Also, it makes us look really good to the AI algorithmic bots that decide what everyone gets to experience. And shout out to them. Bots, if you like weed, at me and we'll get you some digital kush. Okay, enough of that. I'm going to talk again to you, the humanoid listeners, because it is time to get into this weeds episode. Personally, I've got a delicious next generation pod tone ready to puff right after the theme song, but what's that I'm hearing from you? Well, maybe not you, but it could be you this time. It could be you another time. Anyway, the message is clear. This podcast train is about to depart the station, but I am not anywhere near as lit as I would like to be to take this journey. Well, I've got a simple solution for you. Just hit pause. And you can use that time at your leisure to roll yourself a joint, or to split a blunt, or to puff a pod tone, or to pack a bowl, or to endabulate a dab, or to rub topicals from head to toe all over your skin, or to eat as many edibles as you deem it wise to consume, but please, not one edible more. Whatever it takes to get you where you want to be, when you hit unpause and you're ready, we'll all be ready as well for another
great moment in weed history.
You know, it's no exaggeration to say this podcast runs on coffee and weed. And lately, the coffee has been top shelf because of our new sponsor, Vigilante Coffee. I grind my beans daily, no pun intended, and I do the whole pretentious hipster pour over thing every morning. And I gotta say, I really enjoy thinking about where my coffee came from and how it was grown and processed, just like weed. And just like weed, it's worth it to get the best coffee you can afford. And the good news is, if you brew your own at home, really good coffee is an affordable luxury. That's why I'm thrilled to have Vigilante Coffee on the podcast and in my mug each and every morning. Vigilante is a specialty coffee roaster that sources their beans directly from small, award-winning farms around the world and then roasts them to perfection. They support ending the war on drugs, and they want to support this podcast too because they believe that all you really need is coffee and weed. Amen. So treat yourself to a bag of their Golden Bean award-winning Dank blend, which has just returned for its fourth year. Dank is 80% Guatemalan and 20% Ethiopian. Brew that up nice and strong and pair it with a puff or two of good weed in the morning, and I guarantee you will be up and at them. To learn more or to order their amazing coffee, check out their website, vigilantecoffee.com, or you can visit one of their cafes. And if you buy a pound of those beans, well, please tell them Beans sent you. vigilantecoffee.com. All right. I am thrilled and excited to be talking today with two fellow journalists on the cannabis beat, and particularly two journalists who are covering the East Coast cannabis scene. I grew up in New Jersey, the Garden State, but long before weed was legal there, I spent about 10 years in New York as a journalist at High Times, back when it was cool, but I've been about 10 years out in California. So, Jelani, I know that you are on the scene in New Jersey.
Yeah, glad to be here on the podcast. I've actually listened to this podcast multiple times. Short story on how I got to New Jersey. So I used to be a gun violence reporter at the Kansas City Star, and I met Tahid on a journalism Slack. And while I was working over at the Kansas City Star, Tahid hits me up out of the blue, and he's like, yo, do you want to be a cannabis reporter? And I was like, what? You know, and at first I was like super skeptical, because I was like, you know, oh, you know, what do cannabis reporters like do? Like, do they just like, you know, smoke all day? Because I mean, I can already do that shit without being a cannabis reporter. So, you know, so like, I wasn't exactly like getting the gist of the opportunity he was asking me about. And then he was like, so, you know how you like basically talk about social justice issues and put your foot in the ass of the system as a gun violence reporter and talk about systemic things? Well, you can do that as a cannabis reporter too, and you can do it on the East Coast, and it'll probably come with a raise. And I was like, okay, say more. You know, he had turned down the job opportunity because he was kind of working on you know, his specific projects and ambitions, and then he basically threw that you know, my way. And so things have kind of come full circle now. Because here we are, you know, on this podcast together. And so it's real interesting. I currently work for NJ.com, also known as the Star Ledger. I am a cannabis reporter that looks into investigative issues that affect the market. I am a business reporter, but the most interesting thing about the cannabis space is that the cannabis industry talks very heavily about issues of social justice, of policing, the environment, things of that nature. And that's what makes this particular beat very different than other traditional business reporter beats. You know, usually when you think of being a business reporter, you think of things like, we're going to analyze the stock market and who's been acquired and the real estate and the zoning. And don't get me wrong, we definitely analyze that. But this specific business industry has basically portrayed itself as something that can heal the harm from the war on drugs. That promise that was used to also push forward this legislation, it's my job as a reporter to not just understand what's going on the business front, but to also see whether or not that promise is playing out, and to understand the logistical capabilities when it comes to how that can happen and how it isn't happening. When it comes to the New Jersey market, do you want the good or do you want the bad things?
I'm still a journalist at heart. Hit me with the big headline, and we'll go from there. Break my heart if you need to.
You know, Tahid already knows where I'm about to go. The way that the cannabis legislation works in New Jersey, out of the 500 something municipalities, every municipality can essentially license locally however they want. You know, they can set their own caps, they can set their own zones. One municipality can say that they want retailers. The other municipality can say no retailers, but we want manufacturers. It can be 200 feet from a school. It can be 600 feet. It can be no feet. And then you also have this aspect where municipalities can either opt in to allowing cannabis into their municipality or opt out. So roughly the majority of the municipalities have opted out in New Jersey. I guess there are two thought processes about this that I explore as a journalist. On a business front, it is not uncommon for municipalities to exercise jurisdiction over what type of businesses they want. But if we're going to talk about healing the harm from the war on drugs, we do have to ask some additional questions. If the war on drugs happened in 100% of New Jersey's municipalities, then wouldn't it require 100% of them to make it right? And is it a realistic expectation to just assume that the entire burden of healing the harm from the war on drugs is going to be financially put on to the state? I'm ex-military as well. I used to be a fellow journalist in the United States Air Force. That's how I got my start in this career field. When I think about this term war, I think about manpower. I think about logistics. I think about supply lines, things like that. And when I think about the war on drugs couldn't have happened without municipalities, right? The majority of law enforcement in any given state is municipal. You know, the state might have a couple of thousand state police, and then the rest of it is municipal law enforcement. A large portion of these charges were for people that were picked up in municipal surroundings. And so if we know that 100% of the municipalities participated in the war on drugs, then theoretically speaking, the only way that you could heal that harm is if you also had the same level of participation. A lot of people say that there are varying, I suppose, views on what social equity means. But from a public health perspective, I've always defined social equity as disproportionately helping the people who have been disproportionately harmed by the specific thing that we're talking about. And so if we know that, for instance, Black people or Hispanic people or even poor country rural whites, these are the people that have disproportionately suffered, public health logistics would dictate that these are the people that you need to disproportionately help. And so the question now becomes, are these communities disproportionately benefiting? And right now, what we're dealing with in New Jersey is a wave of lawsuits and a wave of municipal corruption allegations. What I'm currently literally dealing with this week are allegations that the state Democratic chair is involved in the lobbying process of getting an applicant in a municipality to city council people that answer to him. How is this even possible? If the general counsel for the applicant is also the senior associate at the state Democratic chairman's lobbying firm, I think that there are probably some bells that should go off in a couple of people's heads that say, yeah, maybe this isn't the most non-conflict of interest process.
It sounds like you're a little new to New Jersey. This is how we roll. You referenced the Star Ledger. And if you're outside of New Jersey, you probably only know that as the newspaper that Tony Soprano picks up at the end of his driveway in the morning. New Jersey is also the biggest pharmaceutical state in the country, the real home of the pharmaceutical industry. And we are ahead of the curve in New Jersey in that I think a majority of our most recent governors have been criminally prosecuted. So
I've done reporting in the South. I've done reporting in the Midwest, and I'm certainly not new to the East Coast, but New Jersey does seem to have like a particular flavor of corruption allegations that certainly seems to be embedded in the everyday ecosystem of how people live here. And one does have to question what was going to happen when legislation that claimed to be about social justice interacted with that ecosystem without sufficient oversight. Because the inevitable question I usually receive as a reporter is, well, what is the state doing about it? And it turns out that the state regulatory entity, the Cannabis Regulatory Commission, actually doesn't have authority over how the municipalities do a lot of these things. The only thing that they can do is refer things to the state attorney general, the same state attorney general's office who refused to answer questions from our outlet in the beginning about whether or not this was their jurisdiction to begin with. And so that's where we are right now.
Yeah. Well, I feel like that was, I hope that was the bad news. it didn't sound like the good news, but I want to say to people listening, you know, if this sounds like dirty politics, you know, that's the reason to get involved. If you care about this plant, if you care about the culture of people around it, I think anybody our age has in the journalism game has had the experience of the crusty old seasoned journalists saying it's all happening at the zoning board. And you know, as we see,
well, in this case it is.
Yeah.
In this case it is.
Yeah. And so looking past New Jersey, you know, I the other thing I'm really tracking is the industry in its corporate form also has a vested interest in taking that market share and not wanting to see an equitable industry. How do you see that tension playing out in other states, and do you see anybody, you know, doing this well, or you know, who can we look to as a model?
Just to add on a little bit what Jelani was saying, the majority of New Jerseyans voted to support legalization. So the fact that we're seeing a lot of municipalities opt out, not surprisingly, you know, their constituents wanted this too. So there's an argument to be made that the fight's going to be at the municipal level, and you know, it's going to be the local communities that are really going to have to politicize and really advocate for opening up. So I've been focusing a lot on Philadelphia. Before the pandemic happened, I was working for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and I currently sit on the executive board of the Philadelphia Association for Black Journalists. And so my work over the last couple of years recently has been focused on how Pennsylvania is looking around for influence as it, you know, starts to have these legalization conversations. And there's starting to be more lawmakers, Pennsylvania lawmakers, that are coming out saying, hey, I'm going to put out a memo talking about adult use legalization. We're going to look for co-sponsors, et cetera. There's a couple things that Pennsylvania has looked at, I think, that is going to be interesting. One, it's looking, there's conversations around a state-run store model, like how Pennsylvania runs its liquor stores, which would be interesting to see and would be new to the, I think, the country in terms of running a state program like that. But I think advocates in places like Pittsburgh and Philadelphia are looking at places like Oakland as an example, saying, okay, even though California as a state is going through a lot of shit right now, at the municipal level, Oakland is trying to give a damn and trying to focus on equity and creating ordinances that help support not only the minority-owned cannabis businesses, but the community at large. Advocates in Pennsylvania are also looking at how Massachusetts attempted to bake in equity across its law and rules and regulations, rather than trying to, you know, silo it into just one single program. There were some good and bad to take away from Massachusetts. A good example from New Jersey is that I think the makeup of the CRC is strong and supportive of what the advocates have been demanding for in New Jersey. So how to make sure that not just an equitable law gets passed, but the people who are running the agency or overseeing the cannabis enactment of it are also supporting equitable measures and creating those rules and regulations too. So unfortunately, no one has gotten it right. You all know this. Listen, if you've been listening to this podcast, you know no one's got it right. No one has gotten it right. The intention of New York has been, you know, I really see New York as good intentions, but then also what we come to expect are lawsuits that are holding up the process, municipalities, you know, doing, you know, corrupt stuff, trying not to even opt in. So no one's gotten it right. Do I think Pennsylvania is going to be a leader in that? I think it might have some good things. I think it might have some horrible things. So, you know, we're trying to figure it out. I think the best thing is to make sure that everyone opts in, like no municipality can't opt out. I think that would be a very sign of a successful start to adult use. And then you have to talk about home grow too. You have to talk about making sure that people have the opportunity for that too. New Jersey doesn't have that.
The Garden State. I mean, if you've been in New Jersey in August, you know that we can grow some fucking dank tomatoes, and everybody is trying to give you a big tray of their homegrown tomatoes. It's not that much harder to grow weed. Home grow, to me, it's not full legalization if you cannot grow the plant. And the other core principle, these are just simple things that you can advocate for, even if you don't want to wade into the process too deeply. Hey, if it's legal, I should be able to grow it. And none of this money should be going to law enforcement. I want to switch gears a little bit. Have either of you been to any of the shops in New York, New Jersey? How is the quality?
I've been around, and obviously a large variety of my sources have as well. Is it better than what the legacy market is offering? No. The advantage that you do get is that you do oftentimes get a consistent specific strain. But in terms of, let me put it this way. I never heard about moldy weed until I started looking into recreational dispensaries. You know, my family, like my family's legacy, I used to pick up my grandmother's quote unquote medicine when I was in elementary school. And like never, like even when I told my grandmother who's been smoking weed for like 40 years, I was like, yeah, they have mold in the weed up here, Nana. And she was like, that's a thing. And I was like, apparently so. There have been issues with quality control in terms of moldy weed, in terms of the weed also being very, very like crumbly and dry, almost to the point of like sandpaper. And then, of course, the pricing, right? Nobody wants to have that type of quality for the pricing that New Jersey has, which is currently among some of the highest prices in the nation. You know, when you sell a product across multiple states, right, there's usually some expectation of price range consistency. And since cannabis is set up on the state-by-state basis, you don't get that expectation with MSOs. An MSO could be selling an ounce here in New Jersey for, you know, anywhere from $400 to $500, and you could go another state and they are selling it for $200 or $300. And so that also does kind of call into integrity the pricing mechanisms of the market. And it also calls into context the sustainability of the market. We've seen the headlines, right? We're all reporters about how, you know, the markets are quote unquote collapsing due to things being oversaturated. But the question I ask as a reporter is, how do you gauge saturation when the market value is not based on the actual total value of the entire market? The legal market is the smallest market. The legacy market is the largest market. And so if your entire business model was, we're going to keep on selling $400 to $500 ounces, and that was your business model, and you funded off of that business model, and you raised money off of that business model, and you hired personnel off of that business model, and then everybody else did the same thing, how could we not expect an inevitable collapse of that as more competition comes into the market, or as more people get interested in cannabis and figure out they can buy it more cheaply elsewhere, because the legal market that we have has not done an adequate job of including the legacy market to begin with. You know, those are just, I guess, like some of my thought processes on why things are currently going the way they're going, and the specific concerns about the viability of a market that continues to maintain its enterprise off of, quite frankly, inflated prices. The price is high because there aren't that many, and oftentimes you go into these states and it's an oligopoly. New Jersey is making some progress, but I mean, for the most part, it's still pretty much an oligopoly outfit in New Jersey. And I mean, we talk about this all the time, right? And when you have an oligopoly, you have high prices, because it's an oligopoly when it comes to retail. It's an oligopoly when it comes to cultivation, manufacturing, processing. As long as that oligopoly exists, the prices will continue to exist. And it is completely in the interest of the oligopoly to maintain its power so they can maintain their high price margins. And so that's one aspect. And then another aspect is, you hear about these places shutting down. And this is where it gets a little controversial, because some of these MSOs or companies will say, well, we're shutting it down because we're not making money. We're shutting it down because the regulators did this to us. But the other side of the fence is, you come to find out that a lot of these locations are also unionized, right? And so, you know, you'll get people who shut down locations that are unionizing, but then they'll simultaneously say, well, it's because of the profits. It had nothing whatsoever to do with the fact that they were unionizing. And not just me, but a lot of reporters throughout the Garden State are exercising a certain amount of skepticism about that right now.
We often talk about the damage done by the war on cannabis, of course. We often talk about wanting to create businesses in the communities that are reflective of the communities that were disproportionately targeted. But I think a point that people miss sometimes from the outside is, every time you are excluding people and creating barriers to entry for people who have already been excluded, you are excluding the people with the most knowledge and expertise and experience in this industry. And there is sort of a sick, twisted mindset among some of these corporate players that not having experience with cannabis is some badge of honor or makes you, quote, legitimate, and that would be just laughed out of the room in any other industry. Do you see that coming around? Do you see an understanding that we need that brain trust of people who understand weed?
One of the things that I have to shout out is Suzanne Nicholson, who is the first Black woman to own a dispensary in New Jersey, Holistic Solutions. It is only 10 minutes away from me. I'm glad that, like Jelani said, even though there are slim pickings, really, the quality that we're seeing right now, it's going to take some time for the new cultivators to come out. I'm looking forward to James Jackson's year, because he's going to throw some good stuff. So I'm at least glad that I get to participate in supporting a Black-owned business in the cannabis space. We need people like her to continue to thrive and survive. We need people. I'm really glad that we're close to New York too. We got people like Dashita Dawson, who has been doing the best of her ability up in New York, trying to handle New York City, and she's doing great. You know, people like Leo Bridgewater. We need more journalists like Jelani. Like, really, we need like 20, 30 more people like that holding not just the regulators accountable, but the municipalities accountable and the politicians accountable. There's a lot of people that are really trying to do the good work, and we need good success stories too. So the problem is, and everyone said it, it's like MSOs are here, and they already have a grip in the market, right? A lot of the ATCs, the medical marijuana dispensaries, are MSOs, so they're here. So it's going to be a very long battle.
Quick glossary notes: MSO, multi-state operators. So these tend to be the heavily capitalized corporate style cannabis businesses that are trying to gain a lot of market share. And what people don't often understand is they can lose money for a certain amount of time if it gives them market share, if they can sweat out everybody else and the competition. But in this case, what they're realizing is they're Anheuser-Busch and their competition is a bunch of bootleggers making moonshine up in the hills. And however many years after alcohol prohibition ended, that still goes on. And shout out, I've had some good moonshine, but more of a weed guy. And when we talk
in
about
solidarity,
yeah,
in solidarity of all craft growers,
yeah, and maybe a little trade. And the other thing is, you mentioned the need for more journalism, and I could go back, you know, I don't want to be the crusty old journalist, but you know, 20 years writing about this plant, I can remember when every full-time cannabis journalist fit in one room and we were all at High Times smoking weed in the fire escape. So I'm really heartened to see this being taken seriously by the journalism establishment, but I also see a lot of what I would call access journalism. People who are too close to the industry and too close to the politicians and are seeing things through the prism of power because they want to be close to power because they think that's the interesting story. And it really leads to, in my opinion, some damaging journalism, some journalism that is worse than no journalism, because it's not looking at this issue. In essence, I see a lot of journalism, and I'm of course not going to say any names or any outlets, but that doesn't take this community seriously. That doesn't take us as consumers, as workers in this industry, and every article is about market share, CEOs, lawsuits, profits. And of course, that's part of it. But, you know, the last report from Leafly was that 500,000-ish people work in the legal cannabis industry. I would say easily another 500,000 people must work in the underground cannabis industry. We have to look at this through the prism of workers, the environment, and honestly, we deserve good weed. Like, it's such a fucking afterthought or a non-thought or a non-story. To start to bring this home, I want to hear from both of you on this. I get hit up a lot, as I'm sure you do, and I hope you do, by people, younger people, who say, I really want to write about cannabis, I want to be a journalist, and how do I get started? And I gotta say, I'm a little out of the game and a little maybe pushed out of the game. What would you say to a young person who, you know, feels strongly about this issue and wants to start on that journey to be doing what you're both doing, writing about cannabis as a journalist?
One thing that helped me, even though it's a cesspool of just crap, is that social media still is a good way to connect with people doing things in the space, right? Like learning from people. If you're new to journalism and you're new to the space, just like observe first, learn, read great books, just like learn about the history of it too. Smoke Signals, Marijuana Short History, Michelle Alexander, you know, follow her. There's a lot of education to do. And so if you're coming in with good intentions, follow the journalists who are covering it, follow Jelani. You know, look at how he interacts and uses social media too. You can get some inspiration from that as well. And, you know, over time you'll become more comfortable trying to figure out what you want to talk about. And listen, people are going to gripe. People are going to gripe about a whole bunch of things. So you'll be able to start seeing and connecting all the dots pretty quickly too.
It all starts at the zoning board. Like, no bullshit, man. Like, My advice to reporters who are getting in on this, especially if legalization is coming to their state, I guess my advice would probably work different depending on what specific level you're at. If you're a local reporter and you're covering it for your municipality, when you pull up in City Hall, get to know who those players are, get to know who the general counsel is, get to know what's being promised at the meeting, get to know what's being promised behind closed doors, and get to know who these people actually are. Cannabis companies are notorious for shell upon shell upon shell companies. And some of these companies are exclusively oftentimes just made for the specific purpose sometimes of getting social equity or a diversely owned category or priority in the licensure process, right?
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because that's really important. And I don't think we touched on that.
So if you look at New Jersey and you look at New York, there are multiple, I guess you could say, lines of priority for applicants. You know, these multiple lines of priority usually revolve around people who were either previously convicted or diversely owned businesses. Diversely owned businesses are oftentimes referred to as not just, you know, racial minority businesses, but also gender minority, you know, women owned businesses, also things surrounding what is an economically disadvantaged zone. What math actually goes into calculating what an economically disadvantaged zone is. What some companies do, right, is they'll partner up with either a minority or somebody else who qualifies for one of these designations. They will form the company. And then basically, there's every intent for them to take over the company once the designation is given, or you have what's known as like a management services agreement where they agree to run the company basically on the person's behalf. You know, sometimes it's just as simple as an MSO owner hitting up their wife and having their wife register a business as a diversely owned business, even though it's going to be a part of the MSO later down the road. You know, we've seen accusations of MSO owners using their wives, lawyers using their wives, people using their aunts, only to see that these people are connected to MSOs that would not meet that designation otherwise. The larger picture here is that there actually are plenty of people in the legacy market that are qualified to run businesses. And so for the process to also be stymied by those type of actions is quite frankly the antithesis of what was thought about here. And I think what we're oftentimes dealing with is, you know, we know what 2020 was, we know what the George Floyd protests were. And you saw this push for racial justice, right? And I think that's what makes New Jersey and New York also intrinsically different. And what's going to make every other cannabis legislation different is that every cannabis legislation that comes after 2020 is going to have to stand in the shadow of not just the war on drugs, but also the overall protests that came against the overall criminal justice status quo. And so my advice to reporters, would quite frankly, to be on the local level, to follow what's going on at the council. If you're a state reporter, I myself am a state reporter, your best sources are not just going to be government officials. Your best sources are going to be operators. And it's not just the operators that are up and running. It's the operators that are out there on the local level that are trying to grind it out, that are trying to get these approvals, that are dealing with these processes. And on the national level, I would just quite frankly say it's the same thing. You have to examine these state houses as a collective entity. You have to examine Congress as a collective entity and see the national players that are pulling up on Capitol Hill. You have big pharma players that are trying to get in. You have big tobacco that's trying to get in. And you need to look at the way that they've already set up their markets to understand that a lot of these companies are going to try to do on Capitol Hill is everybody's going to try to brand themselves as social equity. Everybody's going to try to brand themselves as we care about the war on drugs. We care about people of color. We care about rural countrywide folks who are hurt, blah, blah, blah. Everybody's going to have their own line. You have to peel back those statements and actually look at the fine print of the actions that are being taken, that are taking place. You have to read the fine print of the legislation. And I will always say this, if nobody takes anything else who's listening, understand the difference between what's being made legislation, what's being made a guideline, and what's being left up to discretion, because that will determine the layout of how that legislation is going to go down and how that legislation is going to live in the ecosystem. And the overall bit of journalistic advice that I would have, just as a moral guiding light, is, you know, towards your point about access journalism, the way that I wake up in the morning is I'm always prepared to lose my job in order to do my job. And that's just facts. And when I say be prepared to lose your job in order to do your job, I mean, be prepared to fight the system and understand that it may come with some ramifications. Understand that you may have to move for, you know, that newer job, that you may have to sacrifice some of those long nights. Right. But more importantly, journalism is an institution itself. And this institution that we know as journalism has also has its credibility called into question, right? We as an institution are one of the least trusted institutions alongside the United States government, poll after poll after poll after poll. When we look at that, that should be a wake-up call for us to answer the call differently than how we are currently doing business as usual. You can either use the institution of journalism to serve the people, or you can end up using people to serve the institution. And it doesn't take a genius to figure out that one's a lot more manipulative and less trustworthy than the other.
I second everything both of you said, and I will just add to maybe wrap it up. I want people who care passionately about cannabis and journalism to be the cannabis journalists of the present and the future. And I will say this, you know, weed should be fun. Journalism can be fun. And if it's not ever fun to you, it is not the right line of work because it's not rewarding in other ways. But weed journalism should not primarily be about fun. It should not be primarily about your clout or, you know, getting to go to fancy weed dinners. It's like, yeah, I've covered some fancy weed dinners, but you've got to put your time in as a real reporter, or otherwise, I got to say it, you're an influencer. If you don't report, if you don't investigate, if you're not talking to people, if you're not doing some boring ass shit on the regular, you are not a reporter. You are a hype person, and that's fine. Just own it and leave the journalism to journalists. Otherwise, I would just say, I feel like I had a big wrap up thought, and I probably lost it. So I will wrap it up by saying thank you to you both for the work that you're doing, for the perspective that you are bringing, for the service you are providing, and thank you for getting high on history with us and for being excellent guests here on Great Moments in Weed History. I really enjoyed this conversation.
No, thank you for having us. It is an honor. We are big fans. My partner Ashley and I are huge fans of the podcast. We've listened to, I think, almost every episode. So to be on this is truly a full circle moment for me. And I'm glad to have shared it with y'all. Appreciate it.
Same. Your podcast was one of the first, when I first came on the cannabis beat and I started looking for podcasts to listen to get learned up on what was going on in the industry, your podcasts were one of the first podcasts that I listened to kind of get learned up. So glad to be here.
Oh, thank you. I'm honored, and I really appreciate also that you are, you know, history is an important part of journalism. That was my big point. Is it, you know, as Bob Marley said, if you know your history, you know where you're coming from, and you can't just parachute into the chaotic world of cannabis in 2023 and understand what's going on and serve the function of a journalist without a basic history lesson in cannabis, and not just the prohibition side of it, but the culture side of it, the cultivation side of it. So to any extent that this podcast has been a resource to educate and entertain, I am thrilled, and particularly to hear it from you both. And Please keep listening, and everyone else, we will see you next weed on next Weedness Day for another episode of Great Moments in Weed History. Well, that's the show, folks. Thanks so much for listening, and if you stuck around this long, please consider supporting us on Patreon. You could put $5 on it at greatmomentsinweedhistory.com, and that would really help us as we research, write, edit, and publish a new episode every Weedness Day. Great Moments in Weed History is written, produced, and performed by me, David Bienenstock, a.k.a. Bean. Special thanks to our sponsor, PAX. Go to PAX.com and use promo code GREATMOMENTS, all one word, for a big discount at checkout.